trucks filled with supplies sit across the border from Gaza.
Why are these trucks still stuck on the other side? Why is it so complicated to bring these trucks in? It's not complicated. That actually is the answer.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Today, what it's like to provide health care in Gaza without adequate supplies.
And we take you once more to a Pacific island on the cusp of nationhood.
It's now or never. This is the time for Bougainville to be independent.
Meanwhile, in Moldova, fears of corruption in upcoming elections tell a bigger story.
You can only buy someone's vote if they're willing to sell it.
Plus, a special guest at a Day of the Dead parade in Mexico.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. The flow of aid into Gaza has slowed to a trickle, with deliveries hitting a new low since the start of the war. According to the UN, during the first 3 weeks of October, only about 700 aid trucks made it into the territory.
For context, the U.S. Secretary of Defense says a minimum of 350 trucks carrying aid need to get into Gaza per day to meet the current need. Karin Huster is the medical team leader for Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, on the ground in Gaza.
We hold on dearly to what we have, but that means that sometimes I, as a medical team leader, need to ration, you know, the number of dressing changes that we can do. We maybe use space. The dressing changes for a patient, instead of doing a dressing change every 2 days, you do it every 4 or 5 days. You know, maybe somebody is going to go less often for surgery for the revision of their stump, you know, their amputated leg or amputated arm. And that's not ideal, right? But that's the reality that you might face if you don't have enough anesthesia drugs, if you don't have any gauze, if you don't have all the materials that are needed to treat somebody correctly. I'm talking about in the south, but can you imagine in the far north, in Jabalia, where in Kamal Adwan, for example, there is absolutely nothing that is reaching, but there are about 250 patients stuck in this hospital. The situation there is beyond dire, unacceptable.
Are you hearing from medical colleagues about what care they are able to provide there?
When you have, for 250 patients, you have one physician and you have 8 nurses, with the kinds of patients they receive, right? I mean, there are patients that have massive orthopedic injuries, burns, you know, as well as women who are delivering complicated deliveries that require a C-section. There is no surgeon there. So even if I had the supply, that you couldn't provide the care that those patients need. So these patients will die.
We have been talking about urgent needs, rationing care, for example, because of a lack of supplies. But I imagine there are needs that feel slightly less urgent but are still important, things going on in the background that might cause long-term harm. I'm wondering if you can tell me about those.
Well, you know, something that is not often talked about is water and sanitation. You have people who are sleeping on the beach. You know, the beach is completely covered. There's not a square inch of space left. It's mattress against mattress under really basic plastic sheeting. The sea is less than 15 meters away from people. Toilets are being dug in the sand. With the storms that are going to come in, it's just these things are going to overflow. You can only imagine the diseases that are going to come out of that.
You have called on more aid deliveries to be allowed to get into Gaza. Has Israel or Israeli authorities communicated with you or with Doctors Without Borders about the logistics of getting supplies?
I think this has been an eternal fight, an eternal struggle between every international organization and the Israeli government. I think everybody is pushing to be able to facilitate humanitarian aid to come in. And I think the message is always the same, you know, from Israel, that they are facilitating. But I can tell you that being on the ground, and this is my third time on the ground in Gaza, so I've spent a total of 4.5 months in Gaza, this is not true. We are not having enough aid that is coming in. That is the bottom line. And I have no interest in not telling you the truth. we need these humanitarian convoys to come in. WFP, the World Food Program, has enough food to feed all of Gaza for several months. Why are these trucks still stuck on the other side? Why are they still in Egypt? Why are they still in Israel? Why are they still in Jordan? Why is it so complicated to bring these trucks in? It's not complicated. That actually is the answer. But there is no will from the government of Israel to let those trucks in. And so when there is no will, there is no way. And I think this is what we have been all struggling with since the beginning. Sometimes it's a little bit less worse, and sometimes it's much worse. And right now, it's one of these times where it is not good at all. As you said, it's reached the worst point since the beginning of the war.
Despite all that you cannot do right now, you are still working. What keeps you going?
The people here and their own resilience. Every day, I meet families that are personally, you know, affected by the government of Israel's strikes on Gaza. That every day people wake up and try to live normal lives. I mean, that's what motivates me, is that there are human beings as much as I am, that they deserve exactly the same chance to a normal life than I have. You know, when I go back home, I can go where I want. I can eat what I want. I don't have to fear having a missile over my head, you know, strike me. People here live on borrowed time. I mean, they tell me, you know, we just had my colleague Hassan, we were playing cards with him the day before he was killed, who happened to be visiting his parents and was killed by an Israeli strike, you know, one evening. It feels to me that we have been lobotomized. The world has been lobotomized, and they can't even feel anymore. They have no sensation anymore about what's happening in Gaza. So I come back here because I haven't been lobotomized yet.
Karen Huster is the medical team leader for Doctors Without Borders in Gaza.
This weekend, Mexicans are celebrating Dia de Muertos, or Day of the Dead. People build altars overflowing with flowers, food, and gifts for their ancestors who come to visit the living for a day. There's a popular character who always shows up, La Catrina, an elegant skeleton lady wearing a fancy long dress and a flowered hat. The world's Tibis Isaiah takes us to a big parade in Mexico City for the story of how La Catrina became such an iconic symbol in Mexican culture.
It was my first time at the parade of Catrinas in Mexico City, and I found myself in good company. Keisha and Emily are two sisters who are pretty anxious for the parade to get started. They came from the state of Hidalgo with their grandma. Their faces are painted like Catrinas, which Emily describes for me.
Muy colorida.
She's very colorful and her face is smiley. She wears an elegant dress with flowers and ornaments on her head.
Hola, Catrina! Hola!
The girls say hi to all the different types of Catrinas.
Las Catrinas que vienen en carro.
The ones who come in a car.
Ah, son mariposas.
The butterfly Catrinas.
Son arcoiris.
A rainbow Catrina.
Es un músico calavera.
And a musician's call. The Parade of Catrinas is a new tradition in Mexico City, starting in 2016. And it was inspired by a James Bond movie from the year before. In the opening scene, Bond makes his way through a Day of the Dead carnival that, until then, was not a tradition in the city. But in real life, of course, it's much more fun.
Foto! Foto!
The girls are having a blast, but their grandmother, Maria Isabel Barrios, says she actually doesn't like this parade that much.
Pues a mí casi no me gusta. No, porque por eso se están perdiendo las tradiciones.
Because we are losing our tradition, she says, one that goes back thousands of years. She says back in the day, Día de Muertos was celebrated in households or cemeteries where families can connect with their ancestors in a more intimate way.
Ya ahora los nietos pues ya no les llama la atención nada de esto, de poner una
ofrenda. The kids don't want to make altars and offerings anymore. They prefer to go out to the streets, she says.
Muchas cosas nuevas.
Too many new things. The customs, the Catrinas, none of that existed, she says. In fact, La Catrina is also a relatively new invention by Mexican illustrator José Guadalupe Posada in the early 20th century. It was not created for Day of the Dead, but rather it was a satire of Mexican society. Posada started painting different characters with skulls for faces, regardless of their class or status. Lalo Alcaraz is a Mexican-American cartoonist and an admirer of Posada.
Posada made a representation of a woman who thought she was fancy in a kind of a European style, but she's more of a Mexican trying to look fancy.
Posada's illustrations were published in Mexican newspapers, but it wasn't until the 1950s when La Catrina really became famous. That's when Mexican artist Diego Rivera, the former husband of Frida Kahlo, included La Catrina in one of his murals. The day after the parade, I went to visit this huge mural with Posán Anabélica, a historian from the Mexican Autonomous University. It depicts dozens of the most important characters in the history of Mexico. And at the very center,
La Catrina, la cual está representada con vestimenta.
It's La Catrina. She's wearing a fancy feather shawl and a big hat decorated with flowers. Lalo Alcaraz says La Catrina is an equalizer for Mexican society.
It shows, you know, that we're all equal under the skin. Strip away all the money and the class and the fancy tastes, and we're all the same. That is a beautiful thing, I think.
This, he says, is a perfect match for Mexico's view of the dead and of themselves. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
The cleanup from flash flooding in Spain has begun, though slowly, and the death toll continues to climb. The World's Jerry Haddon, who's been reporting from the region, takes us on a walk through one community in the Valencia region that's been especially hard hit.
I'm just off the main plaza in a town called Chiva. The town was built around and over a ravine, a natural ravine, that had been maintained and lined with stone walls, hand-built stone walls. So much water fell this last week that it just came through like a tsunami, everyone says. It's almost a cliche to say it, but it looks like Armageddon. It's apocalyptic. Just huge canyon dug out in the middle of this town, filled with entire trees, huge pieces of cement, boulders, appliances, bicycles. I was just talking to one neighbor who said that so far they haven't really seen any help. It's been almost 4 days now, and it's essentially local residents doing all the cleanup, organizing everything. You do see a few civil guardsmen and some soldiers. They're mostly directing traffic, making sure that the heavy vehicles can get in here to do some of the heavy lifting. But the massive amount of food and water that people are asking for has not shown up. People are very angry about it. One resident here told me that up at the top of the hill in one of the warehouses, they're using it as a makeshift morgue. She called it the desert of cadavers. A few drops of rain have started to fall, which is obviously extremely worrying. If it starts to rain again, and they're talking about a possible orange alert, which is the second to highest level of danger, the worst fear is that huge quantities of water return to these streets, erase all the efforts to clean up that people have made over the last 3 or 4 days, puts them back to ground zero, and puts their lives back in danger.
The World's Jerry Haddon there, continuing his reporting on storm recovery in the eastern town of Chiva, Spain, in the Valencia region. You are listening to The World.
Hello, Marco Werman here. Democracy is at the top of our minds this month with a number of countries holding national and regional elections, including the United States. Here at The World, we believe strongly that human-centered journalism is at the heart of an informed public and a strong democracy. We see democracy and journalism as two sides of the same coin. And if you care about one, it is imperative to care about the other. Every day, our nonprofit newsroom goes beyond breaking news to share human insights from the people living the stories that make headlines. This personalized approach, reporting on the ground and prioritizing the voices of real people, does not come cheap. It takes time and energy to find those guests with those experiences and is only possible because of the support of listeners like you. So as we kick off our fall fundraiser, I'm asking for your support of this critical work. From now until the end of the year, we are striving to raise $67,000, and we need your help to get there. Please go to theworld.org/give or visit the link in our episode notes to give today. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you for believing in journalism that strengthens our democracy.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The small nation of Moldova in Eastern Europe is trying to protect its elections from outside influence. 2 weeks ago, voters narrowly passed a referendum on whether to join the EU. There was also a presidential election. The runoff for that race is this Sunday. I spoke with reporter Katie Toth from the capital city of Chisinau, and she explained who the players are.
So you have Maia Sandu. She's the incumbent president, darling of the West. She ran 4 years ago on an anti-corruption, pro-European platform. The common wisdom was that this EU referendum happening alongside the presidential race would pull more people out for the EU who might also endorse her campaign. Instead, people ended up counting the EU ballots for days, which was a bit of a shock in a country where a lot of people are interested in building that relationship. And as for Maia Sandu, she ultimately won only 42% of the vote. So that will trigger a runoff, and she will be running against the person with the second most amount of votes.
And the person she's going head to head with is a guy she actually once fired. Tell us about him.
Yeah, his name is Alexander Stoyanoglu. He is the former general prosecutor, and Sandu removed him from his post over corruption allegations. I want to be fair and point out he says those allegations are politically motivated, and the European Court of Human Rights has said he didn't receive due process on his way out the door. Now, most of the presidential candidates who were opposed to Sandu or opposed to joining the EU, they're telling their supporters now in this round to vote for Stoyanoglu.
So what would a Stoyanoglu presidency mean for Moldova and for Europe?
Stoyanoglu has said he supports European aspirations. Journalists have found one of his daughters actually works for the European Central Bank. But the Socialist Party that he's with also tends to take a direction more skeptical of Europe, and it also tends to call for closer ties with Russia.
There are accusations that Russia itself has been trying to influence the outcome of both the EU referendum and the presidential vote in Moldova.
Yeah, what we do know is that the EU wrote a letter calling out Russia for information manipulation and interference. And this is also something that the U.S. State Department also warned about in the weeks before the elections. The Kremlin has denied any involvement in the election. They say the pro-Russian camp should be able to say their piece.
Now, we've also heard about a cash for votes scheme from the pro-Russian side. What's going on there?
So, Carol, let me tell you about this guy named Elon Shore. He's an exiled Moldovan fugitive. He's an oligarch who was implicated in $1 billion worth of money laundering here. And he was recruiting campaigners against the EU referendum and against Sandu. But he told the BBC's NewsHour that he never offered people money to vote. And he pointed to the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who came to Moldova only a few days before the election. She promised almost $2 billion in aid money.
The problem is that money from me is black money, but the money from them is white money. It's because when all what is go from European Union in the United States is good, all what go from Russia is bad.
So that's Elon Shore. You know, speaking of the BBC, their reporter actually spoke to one woman who confirmed she was promised money for her vote, but she wouldn't say by who or who for.
So are people seeing this runoff election on Sunday as a result of irregularities in this election, or is there more to it?
I can say there are definitely concerns about election tampering and people are watching closely, but there's a lot for Moldovans to be frustrated about right now. The country has faced high inflation, a major influx of Ukrainian refugees in a very small and poor country that doesn't always have the capacity to support them. And there's also been some identity elements going on. You know, Moldova has a big Russian-speaking population, and I've been told that it's only a recent effort of the incumbent to try and really pull those communities in and get them to vote for her.
That's reporter Katie Toth from the capital city of Chisinau in Moldova. Consumer news out of Sweden today. The conservative government there has eliminated a tax on plastic shopping bags. The tax, about 25 cents a bag, was imposed in 2020 to meet European Union standards. By most accounts, it was a big success, but ideological pressures could well undermine the progress. Agnes Viljan is coordinator for waste statistics at Sweden's Environmental Protection Agency. Agnes, what impact has this tax had on plastic bag use in Sweden? I wonder if you could put some numbers to it for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started to measure the consumption of plastic carrier bags in Sweden back in 2017. And back then we had about 83 bags per person consumed every year. And the latest measurement was done in 2023. And then we were down to 17 bags per person, which is a decrease of almost 80%. So it seems to have had a great impact.
It certainly sounds like a big success. So what is the position of the anti-bag tax camp? Why do they want to get rid of it?
There is a target at the EU level, which says that we should be down at 40 bags per person in 2025. And since we are already much below that, I think that one aspect is that it's not needed, that we could manage the target without the tax.
I want to be clear of what kind of bags we're talking about. Are these the kind you pack full of groceries or the flimsy ones you use for produce?
It's not like the absolute thinness that you have for fruits and vegetables, and not ones that are a bit thicker that they mean to have like in sports shops and stuff. So it's in Sweden like the normal grocery shop bag.
So taking the government's position that, gee, Sweden's way below the EU target of 40 bags a year per use, what are the pro-bag tax supporters saying about keeping the tax?
Well, you could have a few arguments there. And one is that it's not only about meeting the targets. It's also about environment, of course, the microplastics and production of new plastics in whole. So I would say that it's more like an environmental side of it. Why should we change something that obviously worked quite well and that has a great impact for the environment? Yeah.
I'm wondering how Swedish shoppers adjusted when the tax was implemented in 2020. I wonder what some of the specific behavior changes you tracked or witnessed, or maybe even put into action yourself.
It's turned out that it's not only a question of expenses, but also that people actually do care about the environment, which is really nice. So I think what we have started to do in Sweden is that we try to bring bags from home. You might have those plastic grocery bags, or you have textile bags or a backpack. Or for me, for example, because I keep forgetting them all the time, I just put my goods in my bike basket. So I think we just find new ways of carrying stuff from the stores.
It's been 4 years with this tax. Do you think there's the chance that Swedish shoppers' habits have changed in a permanent way? And whether the tax is dropped or not, they might just continue to not use plastic bags?
Yeah, I'm optimistic, and I really do hope so. And I think it's going to be like that. I don't think that we will go back to the high numbers we had before, but I don't think we will stay as low as we are now either. I think we will end up somewhere in between. It's going to be really interesting to see.
Agnes Vallin is coordinator for waste statistics at Sweden's Environmental Protection Agency. You're with the world. In Italy, young people are worried about climate change.
The scientists telling us about global warming and the fact that whatever we are doing, it doesn't seem to be enough.
But the solution they want is something older generations fought to get rid of. Plus, a walk through a glitzy neighborhood in Seoul, South Korea. All ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. There is a new Cold War playing out in the tropics, the South Pacific to be exact, where the powerhouse nations of China and the U.S. are competing for alliances with small island nations, sending cash, diplomats, even warships. One island being courted is Bougainville. It's part of Papua New Guinea and says it wants to help America thwart Beijing. But first, the U.S. needs to do just one thing. Help Bougainville gain independence.
In the final episode of this week's in-depth reporting on what could become the next new country, the world's Patrick Wynn takes us to that remote island in the Pacific.
It is a hot morning on Bougainville. I'm walking with the island's elected president in his back garden.
I think here you see the gardens, not that pretty, but it's medicinal.
President Ismael Toroama is burly, bearded, 56 years old, and he loves growing herbs and lemons. But sometimes, if he's stressed, he'll just come back here and plunge his fingers into the dark volcanic soil.
If you touch the land, the spiritual atmosphere comes out of our hands. And that is something that I'm accustomed to.
Ismael Toroama is Christian, like almost all of Bougainville's 300,000 people. But Bougainvillians also revere nature, believing themselves bound by a spiritual covenant with their ancestors to honor and preserve their land. Many don't like that the island technically belongs to another nation, Papua New Guinea, 500 miles away across a sea. But Toroama says that's about to change.
It's now or never. This is the time for Bougainville to be independent.
Bougainville is already semi-independent. Its people elect their own president and local officials. They won that right through waging guerrilla war all through the 90s. Toroama commanded the rebels as they fought Papua New Guinea's army, which was backed by Australia, supplying weapons and gunboats. To this day, Toroama easily slips into old combat stories about ambushing enemies with his M60 machine gun.
We were fighting on a beach front. They came with two patrol boats. The first boat that came ashore, I smashed it out. Most of our boys, we fought very hard.
Toroama and his rebels only agreed to stop fighting if the islanders could decide their own fate, democratically. They finally got their chance 5 years ago in a United Nations-backed referendum. 98% chose independence. And ever since, the president has been scrambling to start a new country. But he'd like some help.
We can be partners with the U.S., it will be another new democratic nation coming out.
Toroama believes Bougainville's Christian population, where many speak English, has a lot in common with Americans. He also knows that in this century, quite a few would-be nations tried to start up, but only a few succeeded. East Timor in Asia, Montenegro in Europe, and South Sudan in Africa. These very different places all had one thing in common. U.S. support.
So help me with independence. U.S., is at the top of the level, getting democratic nations coming in. I think it's there. We are for democracy.
Can the island stand on its own, even with outside help? Well, Bougainville is about the size of Hawaii's main island and just as beautiful. But its roads are mostly dirt. People drink rainwater because they don't have taps at home. There's only 10 doctors on the whole island, and the banks often run out of cash. They do have a college set up to train future bureaucrats, though when I visited on a Tuesday morning, it was oddly quiet.
No power.
No power today?
Yeah, no power. This is the third week. No power.
That's Joe Lara, a major political force on the island. He formerly represented Bougainville in the parliament of Papua New Guinea. Lara now runs this university. Just one small building where a few hundred students do distance learning, when the computers can turn on. Today, there's only one student milling about.
My name is Elizabeth Komuniu. I'm 21.
What are you studying?
Accounting.
Joe Lara pushes students to study accounting, finance, education, everything needed to run a country.
We need a lot of accountants, because when you don't have accountants, there's a huge corruption. In government, in private sector.
Lara also teaches office decorum, like where to spit, on the grass, not the classroom floor.
It's a big problem. Spit at the right place.
Many Bougainvillians chew a nut, betel nut, that gives you a boost, like espresso. It also stains teeth scarlet red and makes you have to spit.
It's like a drug. So once you get into it, if you are a student, you have to chew it to get awake. If not, you'll be sleepy.
Joe Lara is a rare voice of caution on Bougainville, saying his people are not ready. He says, first, let's try to bring in the U.S. or any country to train them up as bureaucrats and then go independent. Lara believes the president and his cabinet of mostly ex-rebels are moving way too fast.
Nation building, it's not easy, like you pull a trigger.
During the revolution, Joe Lara studied in Australia. But some former rebels, now in government, say a fancy degree isn't the most important qualification for achieving freedom.
These people, they have the right to talk, but they never felt the heat of the bullet. It's like fire burning you.
Laurie Patrick is the president's first secretary. He was shot during the war. So was the president, in the neck. Patrick says ex-combatants understand what the American superpower really wants, a military base on Bougainville. And over the last year, they've conveyed this at in-person meetings with U.S. congresspeople, Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, Amua Amata from American Samoa, and Florida's Neil Dunn.
We talked about Coast Guard. President liked the idea for 2 or 3 or 4, maybe a fleet of Coast Guard.
The U.S. Coast Guard. The Pentagon already uses the Coast Guard to pull South Pacific nations into America's orbit. Armed U.S. ships help tiny nations with weak navies patrol their vast waters. Countries such as Fiji, Kiribati, Vanuatu, and Micronesia. The Pentagon publicizes these operations in slick videos.
Our team is happy to be here in Fiji, conducting courses on maritime security, shipboarding operations, and enhancing their capability to protect and enforce laws within Fijian territorial waters.
These missions are kind of like ride-alongs, but Bougainville is offering something next level, a permanent U.S. base next to waters connecting the Pacific and Indian Oceans, seas that'll help determine who will be this century's supreme naval power, the U.S. or China. President Ismail Toraama calls it an incredible offer.
The Chinese are pushing for controlling the Pacific, you know. I think U.S. has the interest in Bougainville.
Bougainville's first secretary, Laurie Patrick, says they've even picked out a location, a part of the island where the U.S. built an air base during World War II to fight Japan.
You have a military base here already. It's just overgrown by bush. You just come and clean it up, and there you go.
On top of that, Bougainville seeks U.S. interest in their minerals. The island holds one of the biggest veins of copper on Earth. President Toraama and Mr. Patrick, his right-hand man, have worked hard on these proposals. Late last year, they flew to Washington, D.C., expecting to present them to the State Department. They waited around, but it didn't pan out. They got snubbed.
I was a little bit embarrassed. We were told the Secretary of State really wanted to meet with us, but he was focused on Israel, and he sent his apology for not meeting with us.
They're still waiting for any contact with senior American diplomats.
Presently, Washington doesn't have a stated position on Bougainville. It just doesn't have one.
Gordon Peake is a former advisor to Bougainville's government, but he's now based in D.C., as an expert with the U.S. Institute of Peace, which provides research for Congress. He's been tracking Washington's interest in Bougainville, or lack thereof. One explanation for the silence, Peake says, could be fear of alienating Papua New Guinea, one of the larger countries in the South Pacific.
The United States is interested in developing its relationships with Papua New Guinea, again, because of this great game that is going on in the Pacific.
The great game between the U.S. and China. But Peake is not entirely sure anyone high up in America's executive branch is pondering Bougainville on a deep level.
I don't think this is a DEFCON 1, DEFCON 2, whatever the expression is. Like, I don't think this is an issue that the United States has seized at presently.
This neglect might backfire. Next to Bougainville is a small country called the Solomon Islands. And for years, the U.S. didn't pay much attention to it either. But China did, building a hospital there and a huge stadium. Beijing also flew in the country's leader to China, literally rolling out red carpets. Pretty soon, that leader, Prime Minister Manase Sogavare, started telling his citizens American greatness is a lie.
You go to every major city of the United States of America, you see beggars sitting on the street. It's supposed to be number one economy of the world.
That's a speech from this year. The Solomon Islands now has a pact to host Chinese security forces. So in the contest for South Pacific influence, China won that battle hands down. Bougainville's president, Ishmael Toraama, says he doesn't want to go that route, but he may have no choice.
It's a matter of playing the right card. If you are not listening to me, the Chinese card is available, so I can play that card.
In the short term, the president wants to gently detach from Papua New Guinea. Bougainville could really use a superpower in its corner to tell Papua New Guinea, let Bougainville go without a fuss. Without that pressure, Papua New Guinea's lawmakers probably will not vote to allow Bougainville's independence. Here's Luther Wenge, a member of Papua New Guinea's parliament.
Papua New Guinea is a country of so many cultures and so many tribes, and they're afraid that should they approve it, some parts of Papua New Guinea might also call for independence of their area.
Wenge is one of the few Papua New Guinean politicians saying, let's just give them their freedom. But his colleagues largely think Bougainville is not prepared to stand on its own. President Toraama tells me, no matter what they decide, his island is leaving no later than 2027. I'm back in the president's garden, his lush green sanctuary. It's a place to forget about the conflict that has consumed his entire life, or at least try.
I'm very at peace. I'm very peaceful. Yeah. But when you come and touch me, you will see my reaction. I'm going to punch you. I will not waste time. I'm going to punch you. Yeah. So, but peace is there, you know, and we have self-control.
Toraama is grinning, but clearly he is frustrated. With a United Nations that can support a vote on his island's future, but do nothing about the result. And with U.S. diplomats, who give nice speeches about democracy, but won't return his calls. Even as Bougainville offers up its most sacred possession, its very soil, to the Pentagon.
If nobody listens, I don't care. You know, it's how best we play our cards right and then we move forward.
Toraama tells me his offer to the U.S. is still on the table. But the countdown has started, and he can't wait around forever. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bougainville.
That's Final Countdown, performed on bamboo drums by the Pomlantis Bamboo Band. You can get all of Patrick Nguyen's photos and reporting from Bougainville on the cusp of independence at theworld.org.
Italy was once the world's third largest producer of nuclear energy. Chernobyl ended that. The 1986 Soviet nuclear disaster prompted Italy to close down its own nuclear power plants for good. But now, given the climate-driven push to cut back on carbon-emitting fossil fuels, people's views there on nuclear power are softening, especially among young people. And Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni says she's on their side. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Luca Romano is an Italian influencer. This video he helped produce about nuclear energy has more than 1.4 million views. Romano, who also goes by the name The Atomic Advocate, is a former maths and physics teacher. But today he spends his time dispelling fears about nuclear power and explaining why disasters like the Chernobyl explosion in 1986 happened. More than 130,000 people follow him on TikTok. His passion is driven not by fan numbers, though, he says, but plain old anxiety.
Every year we receive more and more desperate messages from the scientists telling us about global warming and the fact that whatever we are doing, it doesn't seem to be enough.
Surveys show the majority of young Italians agree with him. But for older generations, fears about nuclear power still linger. Today, around half of Italy's electricity supply comes from natural gas. Renewables contribute close to 40%, But Romano says wind and solar power could never meet all of the country's energy needs. And the Italian energy minister seems to agree. Gilberto Pichetto Fratin said last month that returning to nuclear power would be a huge step forward for Italy. The government is planning to draft new laws early next year that would allow the use of new nuclear technologies in the country. Luca Romano, though, is sceptical about that commitment.
I do feel that the government is bluffing on this. There is a lot of young people that want nuclear in Italy, and the government want to capitalize on them when they want their vote.
Energy specialist Michele Governatore in Rome isn't impressed by the government's plans either, but for very different reasons.
It's not a cheap way of having energy in Italy. It doesn't make sense to have nuclear power plants in operation when there is a lot of sun and wind.
Unlike Romano, Governatore says wind and solar plants could fulfil Italy's energy needs. And instead of talking about building advanced nuclear reactors, which don't even exist right now, he says, the government should concentrate on expanding renewable energy production. Italy has vowed to become carbon neutral by 2050 and reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 55% before 2030. Even if the government was truly committed to nuclear energy, Governatore says, there's another huge obstacle.
It's not likely that we will be able to get permissions to build tens of small modular reactors in a country which takes, on average, 7 years to approve a wind farm.
And resistance to wind farms is growing in Italy, particularly on the island of Sardinia. Locals banded together recently to protest against the building of any more wind or solar farms on their land.
Questo terreno è un'unica oasi rimasta in questo territorio, già devastato ed inquinato da altre.
This land is the only oasis left in the area, landowner Venanzio Melis says. Melis told Euronews that his community has been offered negligible amounts of money by green energy companies for their property. Sardinia's local government has now imposed an 18-month moratorium on wind farms being built on the island. Luca Romano, the energy influencer, says NIMBYism is a problem no matter what type of energy plant is being proposed. When it comes to nuclear energy, though, sceptical Italians should talk to their neighbours in France, he says. That country has more nuclear reactors than anywhere else in Europe, by a long shot.
They can tell our people how it feels like to live close to a nuclear power plant. They will all say that it's safe.
Despite all the talk about lifting the ban on nuclear power production in Italy, Romano says he's still not convinced the Italian government is fully on board. And there's a reason for that.
The government is strongly tied to the fossil fuel interests. They have strong ties with Eni, which is the Italian fossil giant.
I'd like to think that Giorgia Meloni and her government are ready to break ties with the powerful fossil fuel industry. But honestly, Romano says, I'm not so sure. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. South Korea has been a major force in pop culture for many years now. In fact, we are living in an era known to some as the Korean Wave, or Hallyu. What you're hearing, of course, is BTS, the iconic K-pop band with a worldwide army of fans.
The Korean series Squid Game was a breakout hit in 2021. Netflix just announced season 2 drops next month. And who could forget this?
Oppan Gangnam Style!
The smash hit Gangnam Style by South Korean performer Psy became a dance party must-play when it was released in 2012. That was the first time many people had heard of Gangnam, but South Koreans know it as a neighborhood in the capital, Seoul. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek recently walked the streets of Gangnam. It's the latest leg of his more than 11-year journey on foot, tracing the paths of our earliest ancestors from East Africa to the southernmost tip of the Americas. Paul, I have heard and sung along to that song so many times, but I do not know what Gangnam is like. You describe it as the Beverly Hills of Seoul. Can you tell me more about what that neighborhood is like?
Yeah. So as you know, I'm walking through South Korea, and Seoul, of course, the capital, is obviously an important stop along my walking route. And Gangnam within the capital is legendary. It's a district of the city that's like the most exclusive neighborhood. It's where elites hang out. It's where the rich play. It's full of clubs. It's got exclusive shops. It's glitzy, to say the least.
And what drew you to this neighborhood? Why did you choose that path through Seoul?
You know, my project started in Africa years ago. I've kind of walked with farmers, shepherds, factory hands, refugees. I thought I'd dip into a little bit of the stardust of the K culture, if you will, which, as you noted in your intro, is global now. It's been hugely successful. I'm a writer, I'm a storyteller, and I was curious to see sort of firsthand this most popular global product of the 21st century coming out of South Korea.
So you always walk with walking partners, and while walking through Gangnam, someone that you walked with was a South Korean film and TV actor, Lizzie Cho. We've got a little sound from one of her movies here, Life on Mars, which came out back in 2018.
작은 양장점을 할 거예요. 엄마 닮아서 제가 손재주가 좋거든요. 이것도 제가 직접 만들고 다 염색하고 한 거예요. 예쁘죠?
So tell me about Lizzie Cho.
Well, when I knew I was walking through South Korea, and because I'm interested in popular culture, I actually approached Psy, you know, the Gangnam guy, to see if he'd be walking me through his home turf of Gangnam. And he actually replied and said, you know, I'd love to, but I'm on summer tour. So I tried to find another artist, and Lizzie was perfect, actually. Better even than I'd say like a superstar from the K-pop world, because she was more an embodiment of an everywoman, a young woman who's trying to make a breakthrough in film. In her case, she's an actress, as you noted. And I was able to talk to her about the struggles that young Korean artists face in a very, very difficult, competitive, bruisingly competitive entertainment industry in South Korea.
Yeah, you wrote about the schedule of voice, dance, and acting classes she took as a kid and as a teenager, stretching, you know, until midnight, you said. Now that she is well into her career, how does she feel about what it took to get her to this place? And as you said, she's still kind of trying to make it big.
Yeah, she's still knocking on doors, right? So Lizzie's in her 30s, which by K-culture standards is a youth-oriented culture, is quite mature, right? She's an amazing, energetic, attractive, smart young woman. But the way she explained it, Caroline, is that there's such a kind of conventional standard of beauty that's required of both young men and young women going into the industry that if you're not, in her words, perfect, you don't get the best roles. And so she was kind of struggling with that after spending basically her entire life since she was in elementary school, right? So she was conflicted. It was an interesting walk, kind of a sobering walk, actually, about the costs of fame.
You went with her to a beauty salon that she goes to before auditions, and we have a little sound of her describing what happens there.
So can you explain to us, Elizabeth, sort of what...
When I come here, like, before my schedule, I come here and sit here, and she's not here, my makeup artist. And then I go to that seat outside, and she, my hairdresser, she...
So K-pop stars, as you have mentioned, have to look perfect based on a fairly narrow standard of beauty. Does Lizzie feel like that is what has been holding her back from big breakout roles that might launch her into the next level of her career?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, she has, as I mentioned, spent her entire life studying the craft of acting. She's done sophisticated roles, but she feels that she doesn't fit this precise kind of crystalline picture of what feminine beauty should be in that entertainment industry. And she feels that directors praise her work, but say, you know, your face doesn't fit the role of a leading lady. So she's often typecast into a secondary role, supporting roles. And she said even roles where she ends up being a villain, right? A feminine villain.
So we've talked about the challenging beauty standards that K-pop stars have to live up to. There's also very controlling management that very much controls the lives of their K-pop stars. And also fans. Fans are very enthusiastic, but they can also turn against stars if they do something that they don't like. Are those things that Lizzie has come up against?
Quite sobering, her stories. You know, one of the things that you see walking through Gangnam, apart from these exclusive cafes and these Instagrammable, you know, five-star restaurants that where you sit in the garden, is a lot of plastic surgery clinics. In fact, entire buildings, multi-story buildings, I counted one 7 stories tall, that was given over entirely to plastic surgery clinics, that tells you something about the pressures that these artists are under to be absolutely perfect, right, in every way. And people forget that South Korea, at some level, remains kind of a conservative Confucian society. So what Lizzie told me is that in Hollywood, an actor, actress can have an affair, can, you know, get arrested for drunk driving and still survive. In fact, it's considered kind of like ordinary. In South Korea, one kind of mistake like that could actually kill your career. Not only do they kind of force these really inhuman levels of human beauty on you, but you're supposed to be a saint at the same time. Tough. She said that in the past year, two of her actor friends had committed suicide. So that tells you the kind of pressures they're under.
Wow. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes that looks different from the glitz and glamour that we see when we consume K-pop.
Yeah, kind of a, you know, an invisible cost, although it's getting more and more visible. A lot has been written about these management agencies that just to give you one other example, like if a young person comes in with stars in their eyes, these management agencies put them through 2 years of training, voice lessons, dance lessons. They police their diets. They police the way they cut their hair. They police their makeup. It is like a boot camp.
That's Paul Salopek. His experiences in South Korea are part of his multi-year journey following the path of humans out of Africa. That's the Out of Eden Walk. You can read his posts and see some amazing photos at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Gardella and Jim Smith, Carol Boschka, Lynn and Bruce Dayton, Janae Elzey, Kira and Peter McGrath. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.